Special education, what families need to know so that their exceptional child will succeed. The United States is committed to offering every student free and appropriate education, but meeting the diverse needs of every student can sometimes present challenges for not only teachers and administrators, but also parents. How can families navigating the special ed system know what to expect, what their students' rights are, or how to best advocate for their child? I'm Jennifer Rooks, and today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss special education in Maine. We'll look at why it's so important and about some of the obstacles that teachers have to overcome in their mission to encourage student potential. Our guest, the author of a new book on the subject, and a clinical psychologist. Maine Calling gets an Individualized Education Program, or IEP, and shines. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios in Bangor, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It can be difficult for a parent to hear that his or her child may not learn at the same pace or with the same understanding as that child's peers. Well, for parents, it means determining the best course of action for their child. But what resources are available to help, and where can a mom or dad turn to find someone to advocate on their child's behalf, especially when it comes to getting an education? Today, we'll hear from experts on special education. With me in our studio, Dr. Andrew Kahn. He's a clinical psychologist and contract provider for several local school districts. He also provides consultation, evaluation, and training services for students in the K-12 environments. Amanda Morin is an education writer and special education advocate. She is the author of the new book, The Everything Parents Guide to Special Education. Of course, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about special education in Maine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I want to start just by asking each of you how you became involved in special education. Amanda, you have a personal reason for becoming involved.
I do. I actually have both a personal and professional reason. I was a teacher for a very long time, and then I worked in early intervention, which is special education for kids birth through three, and then five until school. But I also have, of my three children, I have two children who they themselves have special needs. It varies. They're both what's called twice exceptional, which means they're gifted intellectually, but also have issues that affect learning. So it's been sort of a challenge to figure out what the best way to serve their needs is. And I would sit in meetings and realize that I had this knowledge already, but there are other parents out there who didn't. And it sort of made me realize that it was time to share what I knew.
And you gathered that knowledge through being a teacher and being an advocate for your own children, but there was no book out there like this.
No. So I decided to write one, I suppose. I was lucky enough to have that opportunity. And it's a guide to sort of start from the very beginning when you have concerns about your child all the way through how you work through the system and how you can be involved and all of those kinds of things too.
Andy, how did you become involved in special education?
Well, I sort of fell into special education. I was working as a clinical psychologist in the community, and one of my children who I was working with was having some difficulties in their school and was requested to come into some school meetings and give some support from the family to the school district. Through that process, I really sort of became connected with some of the school employees and their needs. And about 10 years ago this summer, Dr. Tim Rogers and I started working together through Eastern Maine Counseling and Testing Services. And I've been working as a school contract provider since that time. And it's sort of been an extension of the labor of love that we do with the kids that we see, and providing sort of a clinical background as well as an educational support system for them.
Who is somebody in special education? What is special education? I suspect most of our listeners know someone whose child has had special education, but that child is probably a drop in the bucket, right?
Oh, absolutely. There are, I think the latest statistics are 4.6 million kids who are identified as having special education needs. And special education is sort of as varied as the kids who are a part of it. The legal definition of special education is uniquely defined instruction to meet a child's needs, which means the program is very specialized to what each child needs to be successful in the learning environment in the classroom.
So categorically speaking, when we look at what special ed means in schools, it can represent any range of needs from a child with significant medical and physiological needs, all the way through children who might have a very specific learning challenge. So when we think about special education, really we're describing the entire range and breadth of the children that we see in schools. Really, it's just about finding, is there an impact, an impairment that we can provide them with individualized supports for, and finding the best way to do that for them through a legal channel with special education and under the law.
Amanda, you mentioned that your book starts at the very beginning when a parent may begin to have concerns about his or her child. How early do people usually have a sense that their child will be in education, or is there no usually?
There's no usually. Sometimes it's more obvious from the time your child is born. And there are special education services for children who are much younger. It's called early intervention services. And here in Maine, that's done through child development services. But sometimes it's not as obvious until your child's in the classroom and you're starting to see some of their struggles. And to some degree, it's a matter of sort of paying attention to the signals that your child is providing you when they come home, if they're struggling, if there are certain things. And it's hard to know sometimes because it may be your child may be doing spectacularly at math but have difficulty learning to read. That's the places where you need to sort of keep in touch with the teacher and see if what you're seeing at home is translating to the classroom as well.
One thing I think about often, especially for those of us when we have our first children, is there's really no training to be a parent. So every time that a child comes up with something for the first time, right, you know, we're learning how to deal with it. How do we differentiate between the child who's coming home from kindergarten or first grade and saying, I'm really having a hard time with this, because all kids have a hard time with something sometimes. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, how do we differentiate between usual struggles and struggles that may need some specific help?
I think when we try to imagine this process for our own children, it's sort of a developmental process, both for the parents as much as it is for the children. When we think about the child bringing home certain complaints and concerns, the most important thing the parent can first do is listen and be empathic to their child's statements, trying to normalize this, because I think one of the biggest challenges is that children developmentally are being placed in circumstances where we're bringing into question, how much tolerance for frustration have you got? We're asking you to do things you've never done. We're asking you to sit and attend and do a wide variety of activities that aren't necessarily natural to the child playing in your living room. So I think over time, it's about taking in information from your child, being empathic to that information, sort of collecting it, not ignoring it, but collecting it. And over a conglomeration of sort of time and attention, really coming to that point where saying, when maybe should I have a conversation with this teacher? What is it going to take for me to have this relationship with the teacher and my child sort of co-occur in a way that is healthiest for them? And I think it really is about sort of the timing of just being aware and being open.
When I was in school, I didn't know very many kids who were in special education. They were put in different schools. Things have changed, of course, 180 degrees since then. And I imagine for listeners who are older than I am, it was even more drastically different. So I would like you all to give me a little bit of a primer on what federal law requires now. What are the schools, who is in a mainstream school, and what are the schools expected to provide?
Sure. That's sort of a tricky one. It's changed drastically over the years. There was a new sort of amendment to the laws in 2004, which has sort of changed the landscape of special education. We're looking at something called least restrictive environment often. And least restrictive environment means the environment most like other children in which your child can successfully learn. With supports in place. And so there's more and more type of inclusionary practices going into place, which means bringing those services into the classroom so your child's not removed from their neighborhood school or from their other kids. Because, you know, all kids develop sort of at their own rate, and we don't want to stigmatize the fact that this child is having a specific difficulty in this area. So I guess that's a variable question. In Maine in particular, there are not many special purpose schools, which would be a school specifically for kids with learning and attention issues. But there are various types of programs embedded in the school. And I think Dr. Khan can speak to some of those.
Sure. When we think about the continuity of care issue within the school system, and I think the term least restrictive environment, which in many ways for me was a mental health term, the idea is how do we provide a service to a child in the most natural environment for them? And the question of do we pull them out for a service versus do we push them in? The meaning bring the providers into the actual regular ed classrooms. In a variety of our schools, what we do see is some of the specialists may enter the classrooms, kindergarten, first grade. Reading specialists may enter with the children and work in small groups. And as we imagine, younger children are much less sensitized to the idea of if I go to room A or go to room B, what does that mean in terms of my being different? It really isn't developmentally natural for them to feel like that's a problem. So for many of the children we see, a lot of the services, we ideally embed them. We create accommodations and plans for the classroom teacher. Then we look at a continuity of care. Does that child have more of a significant learning or emotional need that might require some time in a specialized environment? And that is done on a case-by-case basis and written in an IEP, an individualized educational program for that child. And that plan is a fluid document. It is written, obviously, in ink, and then sometimes it feels like in blood for some people, as sad as that sounds. But it is a living document. And I think that that's the beauty of the process and how it's changed. It felt like in the old days, the kids went away and we didn't see them.
And one of the nice parts of special education right now is that parents are part of that team. When you have an IEP team, IEP is that individualized education program. It's not just the teachers and the evaluators sitting down at the table. Parents are an equal member of that team. So if you have things that you want to bring to the table about your child, your voice is just as important as everybody else around the table. It may not always feel that way, but it is legally, it is true.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net or post onto our Facebook page. A big question, how good are Maine schools at doing what they're supposed to be doing for kids with special education? You're both smiling.
Go ahead,
Amanda. That's a tricky question, I think. I think it depends on the school district. It depends on the resources the school district has. And it depends on the needs of your child. I think there are gaps, and I think there are gaps nationwide, not just in Maine. For example, I think we're just catching up to autism in particular. We're just starting to get to a point where teachers are trained in specific needs of kids with autism. There are... here in Maine, if you have a child who is deaf, there's a school specifically for that, but not as much in terms of interpreters in the school districts and so forth. But we're getting there, I think, is the answer. And some of that is some of that is parent involvement. Some of that is teachers are being trained a little bit differently. And some of that is that inclusionary practice where special education teachers and mainstream general education teachers are starting to work together more, which is a really exciting thing to see. As a parent, it's very gratifying to me to see that my child's needs are being met in the regular education classroom.
I think that Amanda's covered a lot of nice pieces of this. You know, there's an aspect of education that, you know, as a system, we are only given so much in the way of resources, whether it's time, money, and opportunity for teachers to do what they need to do and to be as effective as they can be with children with a wide variety of needs. So oftentimes you see teachers acting like virtual MacGyvers with duct tape and the best of all intentions, really working hard to make every opportunity for the kids to be successful. And that means being able to be aware of 20 plus children's needs, those all being different in their own ways, monitoring developmental challenges. My internal response in terms of my workplace, I have felt that the schools I've served have done a really nice job trying to be agile. And I think that that's the least common thing in any governmentally funded body is to be agile.
Well, you talked about resources. If a child is diagnosed with special needs and identified in the school system, are there special resources for that school system from the federal government or other sources? And if so, are they enough?
The answer is yes and no, I think, to that question. There are certainly resources in place. And I think it's here I want to make the point that there's a difference between being educationally having special needs and having a diagnosis. And I think sometimes parents do not always understand that there's a difference. Just because your child has a diagnosis doesn't necessarily mean it's going to impact learning in the classroom. So I think that's sort of one point to set aside.
Explain there. What you mean. What could be a child who has a diagnosis but doesn't need that falls into that category?
I'll step in there. I think that we could fairly globally say that there's most any diagnosis. Let's make the example, for example, of a child who has what was formerly known as Asperger's disorder or autism spectrum disorder. Many of the children at the highest functioning range of the diagnostic spectrum may have some difficulties in their social emotional functioning. But the question is, what is the intensity and impairment? What is the actual adverse impact would be the term that we would use in school. So a child, for example, might be very bright and be reasonably successful, may have some scrapes and scraps with some peers, some struggle socially. But at some level, what we may see is that they may not be identifiable at that point in time as being a child with special education needs. So really, there is that distinct separation that the diagnosis does not equal identification.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, we already have to take a break. When we get back, we're going to get to some of your comments and questions. So please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston. Celebrating the season with Summer Swelter, available through August, BaxterBrewing.com. Techport, offering iPad and MacBook service in downtown Portland, Mac certified and locally owned. Learn more at TechportMaine.com. And Maine's public universities. Join the people who are making Maine even smarter and stronger. Learn more at think.maine.edu.
Hi, I'm Robin Rylette with a word or two about public radio. It's radio, unlike any other radio. You know that. That's why you listen to MPBN. We want you to listen, and we also want to make sure this station is supported so that it can do what you want it to do. And what you want is great programming, music, news, and entertainment, not those never-ending membership campaigns. That's what Super Thursday is all about. An efficient one-day membership campaign designed to raise all the support that's needed for our upcoming summer campaign in just one exciting day. Super Thursday this summer is August 14th. Let's do what we've been doing here at MPBN for the last couple of years. Make it all happen on just one day, Super Thursday. Thanks for doing your part.
It occurred to us that MPBN radio listeners know where we broadcast from each day, but we really aren't sure of all the places where you listen to us. Well, that's about to change. We're conducting a What Listening Looks Like campaign throughout August. To take part, just submit a photo of yourself listening to any of our radio programs, and we'll post it up for all our listeners and viewers to see. Also, let us know your name and where exactly you are. For every photo submitted, Hunt's Photo Video, located in South Portland, will donate $5 to MPBN. This is a really fun way to support MPBN. And there's more. The listener with the top selfie of the week, determined by MPBN, will win an MPBN prize pack. How to submit? It's easy. Just go to mpbn.net and click on the banner, or go to events for details. And thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Special Education. With me in the studio, Amanda Morin, an education writer and special education advocate, who is the author of the new book, The Everything Parents Guide to Special Education, and Dr. Andrew Kahn. He's a clinical psychologist and nationally recognized presenter on childhood and adolescent mental health topics. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start off the calls with Larry calling from Milton. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you. If special needs children are bootstrapped upward by inclusion, where is the bootstrap for the middling child that brings it higher when public education costs can run upwards of $50,000 in special ed? Has any panelist done the math on the aging out costs of supported employment, third-party job coaches, and the continuation of SSI or SSDB benefits.
You know, Larry, I'm not sure if our guests are the right people to discuss this. They're not making policy, but helping
then,
others with
the
policy.
The question would be, has the bell-shaped curve been repealed?
Larry, I think, you know, the challenge in addressing things with a question of bell-shaped curve and looking at the statistical models here is that all children involved in educational services are entitled to care, entitled to the best education they can be provided. And I think that the challenge in these circumstances, when we have inclusion as part of the model, is that the goal really should be, shouldn't we put these children in real-world situations? They're going to be exposed in the real world to people with varying levels of skills and varying levels of ability. And in these circumstances, I think it allows the children with some higher level of skill than the kids with special needs at times to support each other and to be part of a culture that supports these children in education. And our goals, obviously, and my goal within the school districts is not about supporting the bell curve, but trying to positively skew that so as many children as possible can reach their top potential. And that means doing this as a group.
All right. Thanks for your call, Larry. Going to Drew in Milford. Hi, Drew. Go ahead.
Hi. I hope the cell phone's not breaking up. Wanted to bring up the fact that not everyone who has some sort of coding, to use the technical term, learning disability, is somebody who has an input problem. Not everyone is a dyslexic, for instance. I had problems handwriting, for instance. Now, in the 1980s, there wasn't a lot they could do about that. But because I could catch up by the end of the year, therefore they didn't want to code me. So not everyone has the same kinds of problems we usually think of as being learning disabilities. They're various and different and sometimes not quite so obvious.
That's a great point, Drew. That's an excellent point. Not everybody does fit into sort of these categories that we think about. But one of the nice things about special education as it's moving forward is that we're looking more at skill deficits, specific skill deficits, where children need support, what kinds of things they need support with, more than the specific diagnosis. There are certainly diagnoses and categories that you need to fit into for federal law, but there are also other ways to support kids who have needs. It's one of the points that occurred to me before is if a child doesn't meet the criteria for special education, there are other laws that support that. There's something called Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which if a child has needs that are not special education needs but have that impact learning in the general education classroom, it's a civil rights law that can provide some of that support as well. And then there are other processes in place too. Something called response to intervention is a process that's in place to sort of support kids and give them different levels of increasing supports before you're looking at special education. But it's an excellent point.
Thank you so much, Drew. And it sort of relates a little bit to another question I wanted to make sure I asked you during this hour, Amanda. I have friends who really resist their child getting labeled, having some sort of diagnosis. And so you're saying that in the system, you don't have to have that label or diagnosis to get help necessarily, because that sort of is, I don't know if it's the urban myth, but that sort of is what is out there. To get the special help, you must have a label.
I think that's a tricky one. And as a parent, that's been tricky for me, to be honest with you. I think we hear labels and we sort of have these assumptions about what they mean. I think there's a difference between labeling a child and having a diagnosis for a child. A label sort of smacks of here's what your child is and what your child is going to be able to do. A diagnosis is sort of a fluid way of looking at what kinds of supports your child's going to need, what sort of help. From a legal perspective, if you're looking at special education, your child needs to be able to fit into one of 13 categories of disability, and that's what they're called, is categories of disability. But they're very broad, and a lot of things, for example, there's specific learning disability is one of the categories. And the federal law does not necessarily define the specific learning disabilities that fit under that. So there's some leeway for teams to make those decisions.
I think one of the add-on questions, too, is that I think that there's there's an essential difficulty for us as parents and as community members to say, why do we have to pathologize things in order to help? And I think that certainly is a challenge. The thing that I try to express to parents when we do this process within special ed is that the idea that there are times where we have to utilize the vehicles available to us. And if the vehicle is called, whether it be called a learning disability or whether it's called an attention deficit, that does not define the child. That defines the presence of a condition that may require them to receive services. As a clinical person, I say to folks all the time, the diagnosis is given based upon impairment. And the hope with treatment and support is that when the impairment is gone, the diagnoses may also be peeled away. So that's the long-term goal within this process.
We have a tweet from someone who says he or she is a special ed teacher. Do you support or oppose the Chapter 33 restraint and seclusion law, and why or why not? I don't know what that law is.
Well, I think the thing I'll say first is I thank you for your work in special ed. I think that what we don't understand as folks in the community at times is that special educators are really, really supporting a tremendous number of our children with tremendous needs. And when we talk about Section 33, this was an alteration to existing law about restraint and seclusion for children that dictates the instances where a child may be physically removed from an educational setting, where a child might require being held in a therapeutic manner in order to be prevented from harming themselves or others. And in the last year, when this law was issued, the extremity of the law was such that assisting a child by the arm to leave a classroom was considered against the law. And alterations have been made to this law in the last year, because in our cases with children who have some fairly severe disabilities, who may be aggressive towards self or others, there are circumstances, and through my beliefs, where I generally believe in a therapeutic circumstance with highly trained individuals in the schools, that the use of these kind of circumstantial sort of supports for safety are a necessity. The challenge is trying to balance that training, the documentation, the support of parents, and understanding what we're doing and why in a way that provides the safest environment for our children. So there's no simple answer, but I think that having observed the impact at the beginning of last year, many children took significant steps backwards. Children with severe autism, with developmental and intellectual disabilities who required safety restraints and supports didn't receive them. And we saw some serious backslides for those children. It obviously is a very touchy subject, but that's my general take.
Amanda, you're nodding. Do you agree?
Well, I do agree. I think one of the challenges, and I agree with the special education teachers, really deserve kudos for what they do. It's a tricky, tricky job. I think one of the things that struck me in that conversation is the training piece, I think, is a really big component of it. And I think if it's going to be sort of part of what we're doing to support kids, I think teachers need to be trained better. I think parents need to understand in what circumstances restraints and assists can be used.
Going to Nate in Winthrop. Hi, Nate. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yes, hello. Thank you for your time. I just wanted to comment that I'm listening to you all folks talk, and that I would not want any of the adult or the parents out there to get the impression that it's as easy as just establishing an IEP or a 504 plan or what have you. I have a child who has special educational needs and is in the Maine public school system. Our town has woefully underserved her needs, and there's so much checks and balances involved with both the parents' responsibilities and the administrator and the teacher's responsibilities that I guess I just want to point out that there's so much work that needs to be done to make sure not just that a plan is drafted, but that it's followed through with. That was never the case with my child, and it was very distressing and disappointing for us. My question to you would be, for parents like us who have tried to work through the special ed system and have found that the school system seemed to be woefully underfunded and understaffed for children who don't fit into sort of a small average, what can we do if going to administrators and going to special ed experts and teachers results in nothing but shrugged shoulders? We're at a loss as to how to actually help our child get an education.
Well, Nate, thank you so much for calling in. I have a feeling you're speaking for so many people here. Go ahead, Amanda.
I absolutely agree. And Nate, I'm sorry that that's been your experience. As a parent, I can speak to that saying, to some degree, that has been my experience as well. We have had a lot of difficulty sort of finding the right balance for my children. And it's a very frustrating process. It's a very overwhelming process. And it can feel like you're just butting your head against the wall often. So I really agree with you. I don't think we should give the impression that this is an easy process. At some point, if you're not sort of meeting where you need to get with the administration and you're concerned that your child is not getting the services or the education that they need or legally deserve, you may need to be looking at things like filing complaints and due process and going through sort of a hearing checks and balances process.
Hiring a lawyer
or working with an advocate. And it can be very, very overwhelming. It's a long process. There are certainly, you know, ways that you need to be sort of, it feels like you're always on, I think, is you're always on top of it. You're always worrying. And that can be very complicated. I think that's where reaching out to somebody else who can support you, whether it's a clinician you're working with who really understands the situation, whether it's an advocate or whether it's a lawyer. Sometimes, as much as we hate to do it, we have to move through the legal process to make sure kids are getting what they need.
I think that, you know, Amanda speaks well to this. One of my experiences within the school system in general is that we can't have the assumption that every parent who sits at the table with us is coming in with the same knowledge and information about how to be a part of this process. So from my perspective, it's very important when we're sitting around that table as the folks within the schools to make sure that we are providing good information and support to the parents. That I think one of the things that would be really useful is allowing parents to have better networking within their districts so that parents who might have better knowledge of the system, the ins and outs, may be able to support each other. Because I think that the big concern when sitting around the table, when the word advocate is brought out, it has the sense of feeling adversarial. So as a school district, you might even see the visual recoil of people at the table. And it's not the intent. I think the intent for parents, as you know, as the caller just mentioned, how do we help our kid best? And I think that everyone's job at that table is to share in that responsibility. And if the parent is not knowledgeable or aware or even able to access that of their own accord, I think the schools, you know, do need to do a better job networking those parents together. Because I think it doesn't have to be a lynch mob or calling all the legal representatives all the time. I think sometimes it's understanding the process, the law, and the language. And, you know, many times in my career, I've seen families come in with additional family members, support people. I have been that support person for some of my clients, and I find that's been invaluable to them.
Great. We're going to take another short break. Thank you, Nate, for your call. When we come back, more of your comments and questions.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Mercy's new Portland Thoracic Surgery Practice with Dr. Seth Blank and Joe Schrader, offering advanced preventative, diagnostic, and surgical procedures. Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life. And Doucette Survey, committed to helping with your land surveying and mapping needs in northern New England. Learn more at doucettesurvey.com.
Hello, this is Robert Siegel. When you hear us say, listener-supported public radio, what are we really saying? Public radio is shorthand for thought-provoking, well-crafted, stimulating programs. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs, and not just the programs, but also the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything. So here's a very big thank you to you, the listener, in listener-supported public radio. If you haven't yet offered your support, please contribute during MPBN's Super Thursday one-day pledge drive. Thank you.
And you can support public radio Super Thursday, August 14th.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Tom Robbins. The counterculture hero is the author of Even Cowgirls Get the Blues and Another Roadside Attraction, among other books. Robbins will read from his memoir, Tibetan Peach Pie. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Join us for City Arts and Lectures this afternoon following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, special education, from advocacy to resources to transitioning from school to the community. With me in the studio, Dr. Andrew Kahn. He's a clinical psychologist, and Amanda Morin, education writer and author of The Everything Parents Guide to Special Education. How much of an issue is it for both of you? And I suspect I know the answer. For a child to transition to adulthood, to have gone through a system where he or she is supported, whether or not it's all the support he or she needs, but has been identified, supported, helped, and then leaves high school. It's true, right, that for many children, Maine law requires that they can stay in high school until age 21, correct?
The special education can serve children through age 21. Transitioning becomes part of that plan when your child is in high school, which is an excellent way. I think it's a good idea to start involving your child in the process as long as they're able to be involved. Transitioning to the community can be a very, very stressful thing. As a parent, I'm not there yet with my child, but I think about it often. And I know Dr. Kahn works with parents around that process.
It can be incredibly challenging. And I think for many of us, as we see the ramping up process as children approach the leaving of the school environment, I spend a lot of time talking to parents about being aware of that the child-adolescent system, for many of them, is going to be a more rich and powerful system as their children are in adolescence. And keeping them, many of them, in the school-related services until the very end of the process may give them an advantage. For many of our kids, if they enter the adult service system, may find that the backlog that's waiting for them is quite overwhelming. For many of my families as well, identifying where their children are, what they're approaching in terms of, are they looking at a vocational path? Are they looking at a post-secondary path? Many of our universities in this country have identified special education style services. The University of Maine has services well embedded for young people with difficulties with attention, concentration, organization, many of the things that they're going to have difficulty with their entire lives. But the supports that are available don't necessarily have to end there. It's just about parents getting educated, trying to get the information, advocating, and finding out what services are available, whether it's at that college, whether it's through vocational training for their kids, which can often begin for many of them before they leave high school. So it's very important things for them to be aware of.
Going to Angela in Anson. Hi, Angela. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Angela, are you there? Oh, I'm sorry, Angela. That's my mistake. Are you there?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I just...
Oh, my. You are breaking up. Angela, we can't hear you at all. If you would mind trying back from a place where you have a better connection, we'd love to hear back from you. Going to David in Monmouth. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for your show. So my question is kind of personal, but also looking forward to the future. So when I was in elementary school, I was tested. My mom noticed that there was something going on with my reading. They tested me. The school system said, nope, there's nothing going on there. And we moved on. I thought that I was just stupid for a lot of years. And I ended up in high school, getting eighth, got to college, and my grades plummeted. They tested me again. They looked at the test results from elementary school and said, it's pretty clear here that you have dyslexia, but you have a really high IQ. So you've found a circuitous route to get to the end result. It just takes you longer. And my children are young. They're not in school yet. They're very bright. And I'm just wondering, I know the landscape of special ed has changed a lot in 20 years, but what should I be looking to be aware of moving forward as my kids come of age and start going to school? So things should I be preparing for in dealing with a special ed system that I'm not familiar with? I'm familiar with a special ed system from when I was in school.
I think, you know, the most important thing is your pre-educational approach with your kids. You know, as you're sitting and reading with them and spending time exposing them to the reading experience and the academic-like experiences is really, I think your awareness is already there. The fact that you've had your experiences and the frustrations that you have and being open in watching how your children go through the process of learning how to read and engage with these materials. If you notice that your kids are really struggling at a level inconsistent with their intellect, that you take the time to do as, you know, as you've mentioned, to look into what those challenges may be, to spend more time with them on the reading tasks. And, you know, I say to parents, there are times where the testing devices we look at, especially the ones we use in school, these are a certain kind of net that may not capture everything you need to capture. A parent's intuition is the most powerful tool. Our first expert in the room, and I emphasize this in knowing Amanda and the community, is that the parent is the primary expert in that room when you're sitting with your team. So if you know as a parent that something's not working, whether it's seeking a private assessment outside of the school district, whether it's seeking some additional tutorial supports for your kids, because as you experienced, that intellect allowed you to sort of forge new sort of cognitive paths to the same information, maybe not the most efficient. And there are people out there who have the training to assist with that. But if you hit those frustrations within the schools at that future point, certainly knowing that you have other options within the community to support your kids, and you have that awareness already. So my concern for you is probably muted compared to most parents, just because you put that right out front.
And I think you have such an advantage in understanding how that can be challenging. And I think parents who have gone through this system are really, really good supports for their children because they understand on a different level. You're understanding sort of that frustration, that feeling. You know, you mentioned feeling stupid, and I think a lot of our kids have that experience at one time or another. But having a parent who understands that experience, you can be a really, really good advocate for your child.
David, good luck to you. Go ahead, Andy.
I have one additional point, and I think that, you know, David's verbalizations there were a little bit, you know, muted in the fact that I think he worked his way around this. I work with a lot of parents who come into the room whose experiences with special ed for themselves were not positive as kids and as teens. And they, unfortunately, by nature of the humanity of their experience, bring this into their own children's experience. And what I would say to them and caution them is that the systems have changed pretty significantly to really try to get more information and to be open with those experiences so that the school districts can prove to you and provide to you information about those changes and differences, because it is a much more cooperative process than it ever was before.
All right, David, good luck with your small kids. Have fun with them. I want to bring up something. We've been talking a lot about, I'm not sure what the perfect phrase for it, developmental, mental health, cognitive issues. What about people with physical disabilities? Amanda, does your book address special ed for physical disabilities?
Yes, it does. Physical disabilities are sort of in a different class to some degree, depending on sort of what the physical needs are. Kids can have physical needs that don't impact their learning, but impact their ability to sort of get around the learning environment in various ways. For example, you may have a child who has a very severe allergy, and that can affect sort of where they are in the classroom. It means you have to have plans in place for contingency plans if something happens in the classroom, who's the support, who so forth and so on. There are kids who have trouble physically negotiating the schools, just from a perspective of they're not able to sort of move through the schools. There are laws, there are civil rights laws that make those things something that any institution that takes public funding is in federal funding is required to make sure that those kids can access the environment. That's Americans with Disabilities Act and the Section 504. And those are plans that you can put in place. You can put a 504 plan in place if your child doesn't have learning impact, but has other issues that are impacting their ability to be in the learning environment.
We have an email question. Could you comment on the success and failure of RTI and comment on Title I? I don't know what RTI is.
RTI is response to intervention. And I think at this point, there's not enough data to comment on how response to intervention is doing. Response to intervention is not a replacement for special education. I think that's a point, really, really important point to make. Response to intervention is sort of, it's a pyramid. It starts out with full classroom
So is this a new philosophy?
It is. It's something that was added to the law as a way to sort of look at learning issues a little bit differently. And it's a process that you start with a whole classroom and you're looking at how the kids are doing skill-wise. And then as you sort of narrow down the kids who need support, you're providing more intensive supports sort of in the classroom as you can. However, it's not a replacement for special education. If you have concerns about your child, you can request an evaluation for special education at any time.
And it's about a continuity of care approach. There's the balancing act of, in certain experiences that people have had in schools, that at the first presentation of challenge, a referral for special education could have been dropped on the table in a meeting. Some of the design of RTI is to provide a continuity to say, what are our first steps in identifying, is there a challenge? Are we doing things in the classroom that are appropriate and helpful beyond what is typical? Are we doing and gathering other supports into the classroom, whether it be the consultation of a guidance counselor, the support of a specialist who might advise the teacher in things they can do within the regular mode of their classroom activity that precludes them going in, hopefully, into special ed or going to referral? And the process allows us, with the use of very specific strategies and documentation, the opportunity to provide earlier support and to make, hopefully, enough accommodations for the child to avoid the need for higher levels of service as well.
I think it's important to note, too, that RTI is not something that schools have to do. Many schools are starting to implement it, so your school district may not have that in place at this point.
It's not a mandate at this point.
Okay. Going to Chris in Rockland. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for the opportunity. I just was hoping to see if you want to speak to the value of partnerships between schools and nonprofit after-school organizations and main communities to provide extended support and learning opportunities for young people with special needs. And I guess, how are those relationships built, and do they provide added value to learning experiences beyond just the classroom?
I think anytime you're looking at sort of extending the learning process beyond the classroom, you know, Dr. Kahn had spoken to the fact that kids are looking for real life experiences. We need to teach our kids so they're dealing with sort of real life, not just in the classroom skills. So I think anytime you're looking at being able to do that, that's wonderful. I'm not quite sure at this point where there are those partnerships, to be honest with you.
I think one of the things that we see, unfortunately, is that some of those partnerships exist with our most severely impacted children. So there may be an array of programs in our areas that serve children who have more challenging behavior patterns, so that we have a continuity of the care that they receive from the end of the school day through the early afternoon hours in many cases. There is, you know, no question that children would benefit from the extension of that positive social and learning experience. And the fact that community-based organizations could provide that, again, is a natural environmental thing for them, which is always going to be more positive.
And I'll invite our listeners, if you're involved in one of those organizations, please go ahead and post on our Main Calling Facebook page, MPBN Main Calling. We have time for one. Thank you, Chris, for your comment and question. We're going to go to Helena in Oxford. Helena, we're almost out of time. Can you ask or comment quickly, please?
I will do my best. I just wanted to say that I have two daughters that are in very successful careers now that were in the Maine education special ed programs in the 90s going into the 2000s, and I had to work really hard, and there were some great programs out there for parents then, SPIN and the Maine Federation program, where I went and did seminars and whatnot that they held at Sunday River, and gained such great knowledge from it. And my oldest daughter is now getting her PhD in clinical counseling in education, and my youngest daughter is got a high-profile job in a bank. So they are great success stories coming out of these programs, and so I wanted to encourage parents to be steadfast and hold steady with the children, because there are some great success stories out there.
So don't give up hope. Helena, did you raise your kids in Oxford?
No, actually, it was Auburn school system.
Great. Well, it's so nice to end the program on a positive note that I'm sure there are a lot of parents out there who are just thrilled to hear that your grown daughters are doing so well.
It's a perfect success story. That's great. That's wonderful to hear.
And clearly an active parent playing a strong role. And that's obviously where this really is driven from.
Helena, in just a few seconds, you have any advice for somebody who's listening to you?
Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't give up. And be steadfast. because
okay,
it's so important in the child's as well education as well as teachers.
Well, Amanda and Andy are nodding. Thank you so much for calling in. That is going to be it. Thank you both for joining us. Dr. Andrew Kahn, a clinical psychologist and contract provider for several local school districts. He's also a nationally recognized presenter on childhood and adolescent mental health topics. Amanda Morin is an education writer and special education advocate. She is the author of The Everything Parents Guide to Special Education. John Keimel ran the board today, and our intern, Graham Morgan, answered your calls. We had additional help from Rich Tozier. Thank you, Rich, in our Bangor studio and from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on Maine Calling, the 2014 World Acadian Congress is underway in Northern Maine, New Brunswick, and Quebec. It's the first time in the event's history that two nations are hosting the conference, which is attracting tens of thousands of Acadians. Join us to learn what's happening at the conference and learn about the history of the Acadian people. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.